This time will be our third time in Joshua, and this time we will look together at Joshua 3, verse 1, through Joshua 5, verse 1, two whole chapters. Okay? Don't get scared. Narrative, we tend to cover quite a bit more. So as you're turning there, I have a question for you. I think I know the answer. Do you struggle to remember things? Okay. For myself, I have a hard time remembering where I put my keys. It was fairly common for me to spend quite a bit of time looking for them around the house as we're preparing to leave somewhere. And you might respond to me and say, "Phil, just pick a spot and always put it there." And that would be way too easy. So rather than do that, I turned to technology to save me. And I purchased one of those keychains that you hook onto your keys, and then when you can't find them, you kind of just open up your smartphone, you push a button, and your keys start beeping. And this has saved me and my family no small amount of frustration and time. Okay? So forgetting things can be frustrating, it can be funny at times, but it can also be incredibly dangerous if you forget the wrong thing. The most dangerous kind of forgetfulness is the kind that threatens your faith in God. The kind of forgetfulness addressed in Joshua 3 and 4. So let's begin in Joshua 3, verse 1, reading together. "Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, 'As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before.' Then Joshua said to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you.' And Joshua said to the priests, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people.'" Today, from the chapters of Joshua 3 and 4, we are going to look at three questions. And the first one is, what did the Lord do at the Jordan River? What did the Lord do at the Jordan River? As you know, Joshua 3 opens. Israel has moved from Shittim in chapter 2 to the east side of the Jordan River. They're about to cross over. 3 days later, here come Israel's officers. They're going to prepare the people for what God is about to do in their midst. And the Lord's instructions are simple. Follow the ark, but not too closely. So whenever the Ark of the Covenant moves, Israel must follow it from a distance. The Ark of the Covenant, of course, is this ornate golden box that normally rested in the Holy of Holies, this inner room of the tabernacle, the most holy place in all of Israel's camp. And about this box, the Lord said to Moses, "There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, the top of the box, I will speak with you." And so the Lord was present with his people at the Ark of the Covenant. And so when the Ark moved, the Lord was moving. The Lord was leading, and his people are supposed to follow him. But Israel must not follow the ark too closely. Did you catch that? In fact, Israel must stay back about 2,000 cubits. And unless you're really up on your Bible math, that's about 1,000 yards, just over half a mile, or 10 football fields. Okay, so quite a distance that they're supposed to wait and let the ark get out there. Now, usually when people are told in the scriptures to keep their distance from the presence of the Lord, it is because of the difference between the holy God and his glory and us. There's a dramatic difference. He is holy, he is glorious, and we're just us. And so the people of the scriptures are constantly told to stay back. Even the tabernacle created these separations to keep people back from the ark. You have God coming down on the Mount Sinai. And what did he do? He said, keep the people back from the mountain. If an animal or a person touches the mountain, they're going to die. So we're used to this get back from the presence of God instruction in the scriptures. But that is not the reason here that the people are supposed to stay back from the Ark of the Covenant. What did Israel's officers say? They told the people to keep their distance from the Ark in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. So the reason that Israel must stay back from the Ark is, in this text, is a practical one. Israel doesn't know where to go. In other words, the people must stay back from the Lord so they can follow him. Okay? They have to stay back far enough so that they can see him and follow him. If you think about it, you've got this huge crowd. And if they follow the ark from right behind it, who can see the ark? If a huge crowd follows a small object from right up against it, who can see that object? The people right in the front, right? If, however, that object is way out there, 10 football fields away, and they're following it, who can see it? Maybe everybody, or at least a lot more of them. And so it's very important that the ark as it crosses is visible to the people. Verse 11. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Skip to verse 13. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. Do you think the people expected that? When the officers came through saying, the Lord is going to do wonders amongst you tomorrow, and they're there kind of at the Jordan River, did they think that this is what's going to happen? Okay. It's possible, right? Can you think of why it might be possible that at least some, perhaps the oldest people there, might have guessed that something like this would happen? Okay, remember, some of these people had been young men and women when Israel's first generation walked out of Egypt and through the Red Sea on dry ground. Some of these people have seen this happen before. So maybe they weren't too surprised by what Joshua announced. Well, what Joshua predicts happens. Verse 14. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the Lord, and as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the Ark, or of the water. Side note. Now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of the harvest. Back to the story. The waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Edom, the city that is beside Zarethan. And those flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. So the prediction comes true. Israel crossed the Jordan River in spectacular fashion, as no one had ever crossed it before and as no one has ever crossed it since. This has never happened. Now skip down to chapter 4, verse 15. Again, we're just kind of answering the question, what did God do at the Jordan River on this day? Verse 15, the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests bearing the Ark of the Testimony, that's the Ark of the Covenant, to come up out of the Jordan. So this is the end of the crossing. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. And when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. So that's the rest of the story. Okay, the first part was the people. This is how you're going to go across. They do that. Now the priests come up and the water is back where it was before. Question number one, what happened at the Jordan River? Question two, what are we supposed to notice about what the Lord did at the Jordan River? Okay, that's the basic story. But what are we supposed to notice about this story? And I want us to go back and look at a few things that I believe the author wanted us to focus on so that we understand the story the way that we need to. First thing I want us to see is that we are supposed to notice that the Lord is the true leader of his people. We are supposed to see it in this text But Israel was supposed to see it on that day, remember? They had to wait while the ark got way out there so that they were watching the ark and watching it lead them, the Lord lead them across the Jordan. Imagine you're there at the Jordan River on this day. What triggers everything? Does Joshua say, now is the time? No, it's the ark. It's the Lord. Everything begins when you see the ark begin to emerge and go out from before the people. And everyone is watching and waiting as it goes further and further and gets further and further away. Everyone can see the ark. You can all see the Lord. He's out there represented at the ark. And then you begin to follow him as he leads you and Israel across the Jordan River. And in the text, the author mentions the ark repeatedly, again and again and again. Our minds are never allowed to get too far from the Ark of the Covenant. We're never left to wonder where it is or what it's doing. Or we're never asking, I wonder if God is still involved in this. We're always told where the Ark is and what's happening with it. The author makes sure we never lose sight of the Ark because it is representative of the Lord leading his people. This is something that he is doing for them. Number two, we're supposed to notice that the Lord is sovereign over all the earth. There are two times in this story, in the short story of these two chapters, and in the short quotation from Joshua, that he refers to God as the Lord of all the earth. Chapter 3, verse 11. Joshua says, "Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing." This description of God as the Lord of all the earth is surprisingly not common in the Old Testament. It only happens six times in all of the Old Testament, and two of them are here in this short speech by Joshua. So it's very rare. Joshua repeats it twice in this context, and it's perfect for what's going on, which points to it being very, very significant. We have here the Lord of all the earth that is about to rest in the waters of the Jordan. He created these waters with his words. And as the Lord of all the earth, he has the power to suspend the way they normally flow. And he also has the power as the owner and the earth, owner of the earth, to kick out the nations that are currently living in this land and to give it to his people. And so Israel is led by the sovereign over the entire universe. Number three, we are to notice that this Jordan River crossing is no small feat. No small feat. This might be one of the few footnotes in the scriptures. Okay? Does your Bible have this in parentheses, that side note I mentioned? Okay, think of that somewhat as a footnote. You're reading along, chapter 3, verse 15. You're reading, "And as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water." Now, the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. The water's coming down. It just kind of inserts in there and out of nowhere. Okay, that statement is incredibly important. Okay, what does it tell us? It tells us that the river was not small. It was not easy to cross, especially with a lot of people, men, women, children, and livestock. This was perhaps the time of year when the Jordan River would have been the hardest to cross with this group of people. And that's the time the Lord chooses to cross with Israel. Of course, that probably doesn't surprise us, since we know from the scriptures that our Lord likes to do things. He likes to act in a way that leaves no other explanation than that he's at work doing something. He loves to get all the glory. Number four, we're supposed to notice that this crossing, this Jordan River crossing, was not a coincidence. Okay? What happened here cannot be explained as luckily coinciding with the day that Israel wanted to cross the Jordan River. They didn't know all about some cycle that the river had and happened to pick the right day and were able to get across. Okay? The author stresses that the timing of this event precisely corresponds to the movements of the ark. Okay, look at chapter 3, verse 15. "The waters stood and rose up as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water. So you got the feet, so that's the extremity of the person, and the brink, that's the edge of the water. So the author is trying to say, at the very first point of contact between the foot of the person carrying the ark and the very edge of the water, boom, they took off. Okay, there was just no coincidence. And then chapter 4, verse 18, same kind of thing. When the priests bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priest's feet were lifted on dry ground. When the last part of that person finally stepped on the riverbank, boom, everything went back to normal. This spectacle at the Jordan River began and ended precisely when the Lord entered and exited the river. The timing is unmistakable. And so the point is, you can't read this story and say, what a coincidence. You have to say, Israel's God did something special here, something spectacular. The fifth observation, we are supposed to notice that the Jordan River crossing cannot be explained away as a natural phenomenon, a natural phenomenon. The author stresses the miraculous nature of this spectacle when he states explicitly that the people walked across the river on a dry riverbed that only moments before had been at flood stage, overflowing its banks. Chapter 3, verse 17. Now the priests bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Later in verse 22, he says again, Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. I don't know if you've walked across a river recently or seen a recently dried up river, but the ground is not dry. It takes forever for that to dry out. Okay, this is not a natural phenomenon. So we've answered two questions. Number one, what happened at the Jordan River? And number two, what are we supposed to notice about what happened at the Jordan River? But there's a third question, our last question this morning, and that is this. Why did God do this at the Jordan River? Okay. Why did he do all this? Why did the Lord bring the Israelites across the Jordan River in this way? It wasn't just to get them to the other side. Okay? There's a lot more going on here. The Lord intended for this event to be far more significant. So what was he trying to accomplish? Number one, in the Jordan River crossing, the Lord wanted to assure his people of his presence with their leader. Okay? The Lord wanted to assure his people of his presence with their leader. The Lord could have just put this crossing as a quick one-verse summary, right? And Israel crossed over the Jordan River. But instead, we get two whole chapters describing this event. Tons of detail. One of the most detailed events probably in the scriptures. Why all the detail? Why is this event so significant? Number one, the Lord wanted to assure his people of his presence with their leader. Chapter 3, verse 7. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you." Now, if you've been tracking with us on Joshua or read Joshua recently, you remember that in Joshua chapter 1, the great Moses is dead, and the Lord has installed Joshua as his replacement over Israel. And the Lord intends this spectacle of the Jordan River to confirm Joshua as Moses' replacement in the eyes of the people. It's not about glorifying Joshua, but about assuring the people that the Lord is with them, that he walks with the Lord. And it works. Yeah. Because we don't read Joshua 3 and 4 and come away thinking how awesome Joshua is. Okay? No one reads this story and thinks, man, Joshua is the best. That's not what we come away with. Joshua is certainly a great leader, but only because the Lord is with him. And so when we read this story, we come away both impressed with the Lord and more confident that when Joshua leads, he is following the Lord. That's how God's people should come away from this event. More impressed with the Lord and more confident that when Joshua leads, he's following the Lord. The Lord knows that his people are best equipped to follow him when they have a leader whom they know is following the Lord. The Lord knows that his people are best equipped to follow him when they have a leader whom they know is following the Lord, who's walking with him. You know, think about it. In chapter 6, a couple chapters to come, Joshua is going to lead Israel in walking around a city 13 times, expecting what to happen? The walls to fall down. Okay, that's not a normal plan. Okay, but Israel follows him. Part of the reason why they follow him is because the Jordan River crossing taught them that the Lord is with Joshua. And when Joshua leads in this way, even though it's a little odd, they believe that he's following the Lord because of what they've seen before. And so the people confidently follow Joshua because they know that they are following the Lord at the same time. The same is true for us today. The New Testament consistently charges the leaders of God's people, the elders or pastors of the church, regarding their walk with the Lord, because of what a leader's walk with the Lord means for those who follow. A church body will not follow Christ. It will not make real progress in fulfilling Christ's mission for the church if the elders, the pastors, are not known as men who walk with the Lord. And I don't mean that elders need some kind of special, unique access to God that makes them deserving of blind allegiance or obedience. I'm not saying that. Okay, like every believer, elders need to be growing in Christ's likeness, but unlike other believers, pastors are called to be exemplary in Christ's likeness. The call is the same, the expectation is higher because the stakes are higher. When elders walk with the Lord, the people of Christ's church are encouraged to follow Christ, and his people together further realize Christ's mission. When elders do not walk with the Lord, the people of Christ's church are encouraged to follow the pastors themselves. And so as you think of your elders here at RBC, thank you for praying for us and all that you pray. But of all the things that you could pray, please pray that we would walk closely with the Lord for the good of this church. Whether Israel in the Promised Land or Richfield Bible Church in Minnesota, God's people are best equipped to follow him when they know that their leaders follow the Lord. So first of all, God did this spectacle at the Jordan River to confirm Joshua as a leader of his people, as someone who was walking with the Lord. Number two, the Lord intended by this Jordan River crossing to make his people more confident of his commitment to fulfill his promises. Chapter 3, verse 10. And Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites." If you remember in chapter 2, we observed how the two spies return from Jericho and Rahab with what? What do the two spies bring back? Do they bring back this insider knowledge of the city's defenses that have given them the key to defeating Jericho? No. They come back more confident after hearing Rahab talk. They come back more confident that what God has already said he is going to do. That's what they return with. And so in chapter 1, God made these promises to Israel and Joshua. He gives them his word. Chapter 2, God shows the spies and Joshua, and they're encouraged. And now in chapters 3 and 4, he shows the people his power and commitment to them. He gives Israel the spectacle of the Jordan River crossing to encourage their faith that all that lies beyond the Jordan River, he is going to fulfill for them. If God has said it in his word, it is enough. But he is so gracious, so kind, so aware that our frame is like dust, that he grants us experiences that confirm and further bolster our confidence in his word. As we mentioned last time, these encouragements for our faith can take many forms. They can be a word from a friend, a fellow believer. They can be an answered prayer. Most importantly, they are the testimony of the Spirit who lives within us, who encourages our faith in his word through our experience of the Spirit. The Father sent the Spirit at the request of the Son into our hearts, and the Spirit helps us to understand and embrace the truth of the gospel first, and thereafter he continues to aid us in our study of the word and our acceptance of the truth. And so our prayer this morning is that we would, by God's grace, be ever growing in our confidence that what God says is true. So number one, the Jordan River crossing confirmed Joshua as leader. Number two, it testified to the people of God's commitment to his promises. Number three, in the Jordan River crossing, the Lord intended to provide an opportunity to teach future generations of the Lord's power. The Lord wanted to provide an opportunity to teach future generations of the Lord's power. Now, during the crossing, we didn't read any of these verses because it's kind of like a side story. But during the crossing, Joshua selects 12 men at the Lord's direction. And each of these men pick up a stone from the riverbed. So these stones have been covered with water for who knows how long. But these men, as they're walking along this dry riverbed, pick up these 12 stones and they carry it to the opposite side. And later, Joshua takes these 12 stones and he piles them in Gilgal in such a way and in such a place that when kids walk by, they will ask, "What is that? Why are those stones piled over there?" Chapter 4, verse 5. And Joshua said to them, "Take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, when your children ask in time to come, 'What do those stones mean to you?' Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever." The stones then were a symbol given by God to make sure that the story of this spectacle that so reveals God's power would not be forgotten. Now you think about that. It seems like it'd be hard to forget something like that, right? I mean, if you saw the river down here that you maybe drive over every day, if you were driving over that one day and you looked out and all of a sudden you watched the river just divide and the water started to stack up and it was dry ground underneath. Number one, there'd be a ton of accidents on the highway that day, okay? It feels like you would never forget that, right? Never forget that. But God thinks that people are going to forget what happened at the Jordan River. And as my favorite Old Testament commentator, Dale Ralph Davis, said, "The greatest enemy of faith may be forgetfulness." And so the Lord makes sure that the value of this spectacle for the faith of his people will long outlast the memory of those who witnessed it. And so he sets up this memorial pile of stones so that this story could be told again and again and again. Each time that a child asks, "What are those rocks over there?" the story can be told again. You see, the Lord is taking the long view with his people, preparing Israel not just to get into the land, but to live there for a long time. That they would have reminders of how they got there, that they might remember what the Lord had done for them. The Lord knew that Israel was prone to forget, and he knows that we are too. That's one of the reasons that he gave us things to do regularly so that we would remember what he has done for us. Specifically, the Lord's table, which we do here at RBC every single week. As we rehearse his great work for us in sending Jesus Christ to live the life we should have lived, as we rehearse his work in pouring out his wrath on Jesus, so that he died the death our life deserves, and his work in raising Jesus from the dead, so that we who believe in Jesus have everlasting life with him. The Lord has taken the long view with us as well, encouraging us to persevere in faith toward Christ by reminding us regularly of what God has done in the Lord's table. Now, for each of us personally, there have been times when the Lord has acted in a way in our life that has taught us something about his character. And hopefully this happens on a daily basis for you, that you see God at work, that you're learning about him as you live and just see him answering prayer, as you see him in his word, as you experience life. But this desire of God to use this spectacle for the good of the future has caused me to think a lot about this week. And I want to observe with you that the story of God's power at the Jordan River was not only for the faith of those who walked the riverbed that day. The Lord gave them that experience so that they could share that experience with others, so that they too might be encouraged to trust the Lord. And so what we learn here for today is that our experience of God's character is not for our good alone. Our experience of God's character is not intended for our benefit alone. Rather, our experience of God's character is something that can and should be shared with others, so that their faith is encouraged and they are built up. I think of the sharing of testimonies. And for whatever reason, in my experience, the concept of testimonies, I feel like maybe has become passé or feels old-fashioned to take testimonies. That seems like an old-fashioned thing. But there's nothing dated or old-fashioned about one believer standing up and telling another believer about what God has done recently. There's nothing outdated about that. It is necessary. And so I hope that reading this story today will make you zealous, will make you bold to share with your brothers and sisters what God is doing in you to encourage them about how he's at work. Number four, in the Jordan River crossing, the Lord intended to reveal his strength to the nations. At the very end of chapter 4, Joshua connects the Lord's actions at the Red Sea with what he has done now at the Jordan River. Verse 24, he did these two things so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. Let me ask you, has it worked? Has the Red Sea crossing and the Jordan River crossing, is it working that the knowledge of the Lord is going out and that the nations know that God is strong? Is it working? It is working. Okay. If you look in chapter 5, verse 1, look at that verse with me. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, so this is the side of the river that they have just crossed into, and all the Canaanites, or the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over. Okay, so when they've heard what God did at the Jordan River, what happened? Their hearts melted. Do they know that God is strong now? They do. They do. News of the Lord's strength is spreading, and this is good news for Israel. But it could be good news for the nations too, right? It could be great news that Israel's God is strong. Don't forget that the revelation of God's strength has already brought one Canaanite to turn in faith to Israel's God. It was Rahab who said, "We have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea." And while the rest of her city heard that and said, "We're going to fight this God," Rahab heard that and said, "This God is my only hope." And she turned to him for rescue. And like Rahab, any of the people in this land, anyone today, can escape the coming judgment if they will respond with faith to what God has revealed. All right, number five and lastly, what was God trying to do in this Jordan River crossing? The Lord wants to encourage his people to fear him. We saw this at the end of the Red Sea crossing. The people saw what God did and they feared the Lord. And he wants to accomplish the same thing through this Jordan River crossing. This is God's goal, a people who fear him. Not that they're afraid or terrified of him. That's not the fear of the Lord in the Bible. Rather, it is to embrace by faith his rule over one's life, and to live according to all that he has revealed about himself. And so in this context, God's people fear the Lord when they live confident of his unparalleled power and his commitment to fulfill his promises. And the revelation of God through the Jordan River crossing should still inspire this in God's people today. So when we read this story about how God did something amazing, a spectacle like stopping a river from flowing, we ought to feel a sense of awe and wonder and shock at what God has done. Because he's our God too. Okay? But maybe you didn't feel that way. Maybe it's because you've read this story a million times, that could be. But maybe it's because your response was something more like, you know, that was back then, this is now, and the Lord doesn't do that kind of spectacular thing anymore. Okay, like you said, Phil, the river down here has never done that. Okay, I've never been driving to work, and all of a sudden, bumper to bumper traffic like just splits, and I'm able to drive right through. I mean, God does not do that. And so this kind of spectacle that God did, he just did that in the Old Testament, and he doesn't do that anymore. Okay. And I would say, you're right. Okay. He doesn't do that kind of thing. And so now you're probably thinking, see, I told you. The Jordan River is cool, but he doesn't do that thing for us. And so I don't read this and get all that excited about it. Okay. But what you're missing is that the Lord didn't do this spectacular kind of thing very often in Israel either. Okay. Think about it. Okay. If this kind of thing, like the Jordan River opening up, okay, if that happens all the time, okay, then what's the point of building a pile of stones to remember it? Okay. The fact that they build a pile of stones means that this is what? It's rare. It is uncommon that God does something so amazing like this. And so my point is that the faithful in Israel could have and probably did wrestle with the same thing you are. That feeling that the Lord doesn't do this kind of spectacular thing for us anymore. But think with me about a faithful Israelite walking down the road, struggling with something that you're struggling with perhaps. They're wrestling with what's going on, and they're wishing that God would intervene and do something, wondering where he is. And as they come around the corner, what do they see? They're walking in the city of Gilgal. What do they see? They come around the corner and they see a what? A pile of what? Stones. Okay? This is, who knows how long after this happened, but they see the pile of stones and they're reminded, oh yeah, that's right. That pile of stones was put there when God, my God, brought his people across the Jordan in a way that no one has ever crossed the Jordan since or before that. They had to believe that the stories about such a spectacular display of God's power are true. And they had to, like just like us, trust that the Lord who divided the Jordan River is with his people, that he is uniquely and absolutely powerful, and he's committed to using that power to fulfill his promises for his people, which is always for our good. And so that is my closing challenge for us today, for us as believers. Number one, keep believing that the stories about God are true. Whether spectacular, like what we saw today, or the kind of work that you saw him do yesterday when he answered a prayer or was gracious to you in some way, keep believing that those stories are true. Number two, keep trusting that the God in these spectacular stories is the God who invites you to trust him today. Okay? No, he doesn't do this kind of thing very often. Okay? And so just like the Israelites were called to trust and to remember, to trust his word. And number three, keep telling the stories. Okay? Just as God set up a way for his people to be reminded of what he had done through the telling of these stories again and again and again, it is essential that we as believers tell these stories. Tell them to your friends. Read the scriptures together. Tell them to your kids, to your wives, to your husbands. These stories are how we know who God is, that he is the leader of his people, that he is the Lord of all the earth, that he can do wondrous things, that he cares about us. Most specifically, keep telling the story where God demonstrated his power in a way that even transcends the Jordan River crossing. And that would be, of course, when Christ died on the cross and the Father raised him from the dead. Even better than the Jordan River crossing, that story tells the power of God. And as Paul says, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, the one who did that amazing thing, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Paul goes on to say that nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. There's nothing that can happen this week or last week, no matter how painful, how hard it is, that can stop God from doing for us what we need to look more like Jesus as he works to conform us into the image of his Son. And so the Lord calls us today to see him again as the great Lord of all the earth, who can do something like Jordan River Crossing and who cares for us, his people, is committed to our good, to our looking like Jesus.